Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, or you'd like to call to raise an alternate viewpoint to that of the host, you're welcome to do that here. There's a phone number for you to use if you'd like to call me today. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is Brad from Kuski, Idaho. Brad, welcome to the Narrow Path. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, I haven't talked to you in a long time.
It has been a while.
Been wanting to, but I was unable to. I guess I have an alternate viewpoint today.
Uh-huh.
Friday, when you were talking about Martin Luther.
Yeah.
I believe, from my understanding of the history, you're quite wrong on your assessment of Martin Luther. I don't think that it was just a medieval thought on why he was against the peasants and against the Jews. I think it's pretty well established that he needed the help of the state to accomplish the breakaway from the Catholics. And the peasants were working, actually, whether they realized it or not, for the Roman Emperor. And so were the Jews. And to a smaller degree, the Anabaptists. What do you think about that?
I mean, they were working for the Roman Emperor, or for the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, or you mean the Roman Pope?
Well, the Holy Roman Empire, because in order for the Reformation really to happen, the reformers, the Christians, the true Christians, needed the help of the state. So, like, the first definition of state would be the opposite of imperialist. So Luther understood that in order to bring about a Christian breakaway from the Catholics, there needed to be a breakaway on the realm of state from the imperialist. And so I don't believe that he was just... I believe it was a well-thought-out position of Martin Luther's, not just what you were saying, kind of a culture of hating the Jews.
Well, you may be right, but he was certainly not the first to take that stand against the Jews.
Right, you know. Do you understand that the Jews, they were brought into that area by William the Conqueror, and so there was animosity with the Jews for several hundred years, I admit that. But it was because quite often, not always, but quite often, the Jews were kind of a destructive force in the communities of the Germanic tribes. And that's why William the Conqueror brought them, because they were kind of a way for him to collect taxes.
Okay.
So it is true.
Well,
you know,
I have to say I'm not following exactly what your basic point is, except that you're saying that I said that the reason that Luther said such horrible things about the Jews is because he was a product of his age,
right.
And that in those days, to be a heretic was regarded to be sort of like a traitor against the state, because the church and the state were not really distinguished that much. and you're saying that he had more of a political strategy in it. Is that what you're saying?
Right. I don't think it was a hatred. Based on his own writings, and you know he was very prolific in his writings, so his own words, I think, justify him. He just understood that if the peasant revolt actually worked, then the Holy Roman Empire would have just easily crushed the whole Reformation, including the peasants. Same with the Jews. It was like the Jews were actually working for the Holy Roman Empire against the Germanic states, specifically the one that
lived in. You know, I know that you're pretty, you're a lot more knowledgeable about a lot of arcane historical facts than I am. So I'm going to take your word for that. But I don't really... I don't think a Christian who had the Spirit of Christ would say those things about the Jews or about the peasants unless he was very much blind, had a big blind spot.
Well, or unless he truly understood biblical justice. So, you know, there is a time when you don't just allow innocent people to be slaughtered or whatever. And I'm not talking about, I realize that if I'm being attacked because of my Christianity, I should allow that. But if I'm just being attacked so somebody can kill me and steal from me, that's different. And so I think Martin Luther understood the difference. So, you know, if you ever look at the peasant revolt, it was pretty crazy. I mean, they were just killing. I mean, the peasants were just destroying everything needlessly. And my main thing is I was defending Martin Luther. But that doesn't mean I'm defending John Calvin. A lot of people think if I defend Martin Luther, I'm defending everybody. But specifically, I believe Martin Luther was very, a very good man, and what he did, he had to do. Or the Reformation wouldn't have happened.
All right. Well, we're going to have to let you have your say on that, because I can't prove you wrong.
Well, I just felt bad for Martin Luther. He actually said one time that he hopes history remembers him correctly. And so I hate to see history not. And also, I did get your Christmas card. Thank you.
All right. God bless you, Brad.
Okay. Take care.
God bless you. Bye now.
Bye.
All right. Our lines are open now. And if you'd like to be on the program, if you have a question about the Bible or the Christian faith, or as in the case of Brad, had an alternate viewpoint from that of the host to share, feel free to give me a call. Our lines are open. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And for those of you listening in Santa Cruz or in the area, Santa Cruz area, I will be coming up to Santa Cruz again in a couple of weeks on Saturday the 18th. It's just a quick breeze through because I'm on my way elsewhere, but I'm passing through Santa Cruz. So on the 18th of Saturday, 7 o'clock, we have our open Bible discussion, our Q&A time for anyone who'd like to come. And it's held in a home. And, if everyone comes who came last time, we may have a hard time. The house was full, but it was nice. We liked having all those people there. But you're welcome to call. We're not putting the address on the website, but we are giving you a contact email. So if you'd like to get the address where we're meeting on Saturday the 18th in Santa Cruz, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and click on the announcements link, and you'll find there the contact information you need. All right, let's talk to Matthew from Everett, Washington. Matthew, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I just have a question about the genealogy or the bloodline of Jesus Christ.
Uh-huh.
In Matthew 1, it traces his bloodline from Abraham to David and David down to Joseph. But Mary was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering how it is that Jesus is linked all the way back to Abraham if Joseph, like, wasn't his...
Yeah, well, Matthew does refer to him as the son of Abraham and the son of David, and then it's interesting he gives a genealogy of Joseph, which is not Jesus' own genealogy, since Matthew makes it very clear that Joseph was not his father. But in the Jewish mind... And in most cultures, not just Jewish, but in most cultures, if a man adopts a child, that child is like a legal son of his, of course. And therefore, since Joseph adopted Jesus and Joseph was his legal father, was presumed to be his natural father by most people, therefore Joseph's genealogy would have been the genealogy that would give Jesus whatever standing he had in the Jewish society. His mother's genealogy would not give him standing, because in those days they just didn't look at those facts. They looked at the fathers. Now, Joseph was not his natural father, but he was his legal father. He was his adoptive father. And therefore, that would be Jesus' legal standing in society descended from the kings of Judah. Now, Luke, in Luke chapter 3, gives another genealogy of Christ, and there are different opinions about that one, but I believe it's Mary's genealogy. And you'll find that Mary also is descended from David and from Abraham. So you can see that Jesus, who was Mary's natural child, of course, or I don't know if we'd call it natural, supernatural child, but came through Mary and through her bloodline, came through her family. She was also descended from David and Abraham. So Jesus was, in fact, descended from Abraham and David biologically. But he was. But Matthew is more concerned about showing his royal standing, as Joseph came through the royal line more than Mary did. And Jesus' legal standing in society would be that of Joseph.
Okay. And you said that was in Luke 3?
Luke 3, beginning at verse 23.
Okay. Cool.
All right. Now, I'll warn you in advance, if you're going to read Luke 3:23, it's going to sound ambiguous, because it's going to say Jesus began his ministry when he was about 30 years old, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Heli, and so forth. And it sounds like Luke is giving Joseph's genealogy, but he's actually giving an entirely different genealogy than that which Joseph had in Matthew. And I believe what Luke is saying, that Jesus was believed to be the son of Joseph, but was actually the son of Heli. And Heli would be, his son of means descendant of. It doesn't have to be a first-generation son, a son of somebody. Like, well, for example, when Jesus called the son of Abraham or the son of David, there's many generations between, but he's still the son of them. And Jesus was actually the son of Heli. That is, he descended through the line of Heli, who would have to be Mary's father in that case.
All right. Well, that clears some things up for me. Thank you very much.
Okay. God bless you, Matthew.
You too. Bye.
Good talking to you. Okay. Our next caller is Mark. We talked to Matthew. Now, Mark. We don't have Luke up next, but Mark is from Beaverton, Oregon. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Mark.
Hi, thanks. I was reading in the Bible, and I can't remember exactly where it was, but you may know, where Jesus says, "To he that overcometh, I will give a crown of life."
Yeah, that's Revelation 2:10. Well, I take that back. In Revelation 2:10, he says, endure unto the end, and I will give you the crown of life. But there's, I think it's a few verses later that he said, he that overcomes will receive. I'm looking for it now, but it's in Revelation chapter 2 or 3 here. I'm looking. Oh, here it is, yeah. Yeah, it's, well, it says at the end of verse 10, be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life.
Okay. Okay, yeah, that sounds right, because I was reading Revelation last night.
Okay.
So I was wondering, what is it that he is talking about overcoming?
Well, in the book of Revelation and in John's writings, overcoming is a unique phrase that John alone uses. Jesus uses it in John 16:33, where he says, these things I've spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world you'll have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. So Jesus had overcome the world. It says in 1 John, I write unto you, young men, because you've overcome the wicked one. And in 1 John chapter 5, it says, whoever is born of God overcomes the world. And then in Revelation, 7 times in the churches, Jesus says, whoever overcomes. He doesn't say overcomes what. But in John's other writings, and Revelation is one of John's writings, it's the devil or the world who is overcome. Jesus overcame the world. Whoever is born of God, Christians overcome the world, according to 1 John 5. And so probably overcoming the world, that is the resistance of the world. The word overcome suggests there's a conflict. There's a, you know, the word overcome means to conquer. So it suggests there's a climate of warfare. And the war is a spiritual war, that the world's ways, the world's culture, the world's allure, which the devil exploits to try to get us to compromise and to defect from Christ, that is the enemy. And we fight against that. And if we overcome it, it means we don't succumb to the devil or the world and their allure. We stay faithful to Christ. So to overcome means to stay on course and stay faithful to what God has called us to do, in spite of the fact that there's many attacks against us to try to get us to stop doing so.
Okay, so it's not just the one-time event of salvation. It's the ongoing battle you fight through your whole life.
Well, yeah, I believe it is. I believe it is.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mark, thanks for your call. God bless you. All right, our next caller is Brent from Gresham, Oregon, and we have one line open for you right now if you'd like to call 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Brent, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon, Steve. As always, a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Today, I'd like to make a comment, bounce a comment off of you and kind of get your opinion.
Okay.
I listen to quite a few radio programs, Christian radio programs, on this station and others. And, you know, just an observation, your program is just so unique in that, you know, you welcome, debate. You don't hide or run away from, opposition, because you know that truth is not something to be afraid of. The problem with other programs that I see that don't have this sort of format is that they don't really let the other side in, if you will. And the other thing that I see going on in these programs as well is harping on one of many sins. I just off the top of my head, homosexuality seems to be a real sticking point with a lot of these programs. And I agree, you know, it is a sin, and it's an issue that it has merit and needs to be dealt with, but it's one of many. And it just seems that if we are to follow the Great Commission that Jesus has given us, to seek and save the lost and to love our neighbor as ourselves, that showing visceral anger and hatred towards people because of their sin, just seems like the wrong way to go about it. Mm-hmm. And I just really want, like, your opinion on that.
Yeah, well, there's a couple things you mentioned that I'd like to respond to. One is, you said that most other programs don't let you interact, and that really is just a function of their format. Obviously, most radio programs are recorded in advance, and they don't really allow much interaction. Now, I don't know what would happen if you wrote to them with a disagreement, and I don't know if they would ever read it over the air. They might not, because they might get too many letters, and also, you know, a lot of programs are just taking some pastor's sermon and editing it into a half-hour slot. So it's obviously, by the nature of it, it's not going to be interactive, and you can't blame them for that. I mean, if the guy's a good preacher, there's people who want to hear him preach and don't necessarily want to hear him argue with somebody.
Right.
About
no, somebody. I'm specifically talking about programs where you get to call in.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't hear very many of them, but I guess you may be right. I think that I'm much more interested in hearing other viewpoints than a lot of ministers, I think, are. I don't know why that is. I don't know why they're not more interested. I find it fascinating to interact with people who see things differently. But
absolutely.
Now, on the homosexual thing, I think one reason that Christian broadcasts bring up homosexuality more than perhaps most other sins, especially at this present time, is because most sins have not been politicized. That is to say, there's not a lobby out there asking for special rights for thieves, or special rights for adulterers, or special rights for people who disrespect their parents, or things like that. Or special
abortion.
Rights. What's that?
Abortion.
Yeah, well, there are people who want that. That's a murder. Yeah, that's another one that I think homosexuality and murder are the ones mentioned most often, because
right.
by Christians, because they are the, as far as I can tell, they're really the only sins that have political lobbies out there trying to push for their normalization. And while I think that most Christians don't want to just live and let live with reference to abortion, because they feel like they're seeing murder taking place and that somebody needs to speak up for those who can't defend themselves. But I think most Christians, I think, would be glad to just let the homosexual people do whatever they're going to do if they weren't trying to politicize it, and politicize it in such a way that it becomes illegal to disagree with them, and so that they actually, you know, want to change the definitions of marriage and things like that. Now, those are absolutely unnecessary things. And I think those agendas that have caused Christians often to be more alarmed by homosexuality in our culture at this present time than they appear to be about other sins. I can't speak for most Christians. I know myself. I'm no more alarmed by a person who's engaged in homosexuality than I am alarmed by somebody who's divorcing his wife for no good reason, you know, or committing some other kind of sins. I don't find homosexuality as a sin more alarming than others, but homosexual advocates are pushing for things, especially making it virtually illegal. It's not quite illegal yet. It's gotten that way in Canada. It's not that way here yet. But they're going for it, to make it essentially illegal to denounce that particular sin. And that's really, I think, why.
Yeah, I don't agree
with that.
You hear more
about it. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just saying that when some Christians approach the subject, they are more hateful towards the person than towards the sin.
Yeah, well, that certainly isn't a Christian attitude. And I think I think you've always been able to find religious people who have that attitude towards sinners. Before there was a lot of homosexuality out in the open in our culture, I'm sure there were people doing that about pornography and doing that about a lot of drunkenness and things like that too. I mean, frankly, there's always been a certain kind of Christian that likes to get their back up and be confrontational about the sins of people they're trying to reach. I don't find that Jesus did that. Jesus did confront the sins of the Pharisees. They were the religious, and their sin was their religiosity. But the tax collectors and the prostitutes and the sinners, we never read of Jesus ever speaking out against them. He seemed to befriend them. Now, that doesn't mean that he approved of them. He didn't have to say he disapproved. They knew he disapproved. They were doing things that even they disapproved of. I mean, the whole society disapproved of them. They didn't have to be told that they were doing the wrong thing. Instead, they needed to be told that God is like a father with wanting his prodigals to come home, and who loves them anyway and wants to be reconciled with them. So, I mean, Jesus' approach to sinners was not one of giving a laundry list of their sins and screeching in anger at them for them. We don't find him ever doing that really toward people we call sinners. He did that somewhat toward the Pharisees.
Yeah, my idea is that what better way to bring someone to Christ, to be rude and hateful towards them, or to be loving and not accepting of their sin, but just treating them Christ-like, like Christ treated sinners of his day. I mean,
I hear you. I hear
we're
you.
All sinners, so
I agree. I think you're right.
I really, really appreciate your input on that, Steve.
Well, Brandon, it's good to hear from you. I appreciate your call.
God bless you.
You too. Bye now. All right. Our next caller is Brenda, calling from Freeland, Washington. Brenda, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Happy and healthy New Year to you.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you. My quick question, which is pretty simple, is, I'm curious what study Bible you really prefer when you're doing your in-depth studies. That's kind of an aside. And then I had but maybe you can answer that real quick because I'll forget too.
Okay, hold on to your second question. First of all, when you say study Bible, do you just mean what translation do I like to read, or do you mean a study Bible like the Ryrie Study Bible or the Schofield Study Bible or the MacArthur Study Bible? Are you talking about that kind of study Bible?
See, maybe so, because okay. I like reading the King James, but I have many different Bibles and study Bibles, so I'm just kind of curious what you get the most out of.
Okay, well, I need to make this clear because sometimes people use the term and differently than I think of it. A study Bible is a Bible that some teacher or some committee has added explanatory notes, usually at the bottom of the page. And let's just take the Scofield Bible, for example, which was the first one that ever came out back in 1909. The Scofield Reference Bible can be gotten in King James or in NIV or New American Standard or other translations.
Right.
So a study Bible has more to do, is defined more by the notes
Right. And scholars. So I kind of wonder, which one do you agree with the most, or which one do you refer to the most, short of just going right to the Word yourself?
Well, I don't use study Bibles very often, but I sometimes do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree with most study Bible notes because most of them are written by dispensationalists. All the ones I mentioned, John MacArthur, Scofield, Ryrie, and many others, are written by dispensationalists, and so their notes are going to explain things in a dispensational way, which I don't approve.
Right, and then sometimes you come to a spot where you need help with, and they don't have an opinion either.
Yeah, and really, the notes at the bottom of the page of a study Bible are really just the same thing as a commentary, but not very in-depth.
Right.
And so my shelf has a lot of commentaries on it. And if I want to study something in depth, I'm more likely to pull a commentary off the shelf than to go to a study Bible that just has a few lines at the bottom of the page on the side.
So what one do you prefer there?
Commentaries, also I have to say I don't agree with any of them completely, but one set of commentaries I think is really helpful it's called the Tyndale commentary series. They have a set, they're paperback, so they're less expensive than some.
Okay.
And there's a set of them, but there's still hundreds of dollars for all them because there's like 40 or 50 of them.
Okay.
But there's a Tyndale set of commentaries on the Old Testament, and there's a Tyndale set on the New Testament. Now these volumes are written by different scholars.
Okay.
And I have to say that most of the scholars that write them I had not heard of, except from the commentary set. But actually, they're all really good. They're all really good scholars, and they try to be objective. Mm-hmm. They don't appear to be dispensational, but that doesn't mean I would agree with everything they say. They may tend to be a little bit on the Reformed side, that is Calvinist side, but they don't seem to be extremely so. The fact that they have somebody like N.T. Wright writes one of them, and I know him outside of the commentary set, and F.F. Bruce is one of their writers. Derek Kidner is a great Old Testament commentator who they use. And so they really have chosen some really top-flight guys to write these different volumes. And it's a bit of an investment because, like I say, it's quite a few volumes, but they're small paperbacks and they're less expensive that way than they would be. And if you go to christianbook.com and look up Tyndale, T-Y-N-D-A-L-E, commentaries, I'm sure that both the Old Testament and the New Testament sets will come up, and better brace yourself for some sticker shock. But it's going to be cheaper than most.
I might look for friends to borrow from,
okay.
But it points me in the right direction. And then the other question was about Matthew 16:19 and Matthew 18:18, because I have friends I love dearly, and I do believe they're true believers, but they're also Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And like one of the reasons I was told recently was because he gave Peter the keys of the kingdom, and I felt like the Lord was probably talking to all the disciples, not just him.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to say anything at the time because I really wasn't prepared. And then on 18:18 it said, whatsoever you bind on earth, you'll bind in heaven, and loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. So I felt that was similar. But if they say that's why Peter, and that's where the Pope comes from, Peter that way, mm-hmm. how come they don't pick up on the line that calls him Satan a little bit further down?
That's a good question. Yeah, it's later in the same chapter. Well, actually, it's earlier in the same. Yeah.
Okay.
But of chapter 16. What shall I say?
How can I show that it wasn't speaking to just one disciple? Maybe, and I thought 18:18 might have shown that. And also, because under 18:18 on 21, Peter was asking, how often should I forgive him? Was he only talking to Peter about how often we forgive? No.
Good point. Right, exactly. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that when Jesus made the statement to Peter, I'll give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. He was just speaking to Peter as one of the apostles. The same would apply to the apostles. And the reason is the one you gave. Two chapters later, he makes the same promise to all the apostles. He doesn't, in the second case, he doesn't mention the keys. But he does say to all of them, whatsoever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. So it sounds in Matthew 16:19 that binding and loosing is what those keys are all about. And so to say I'm giving you the keys and whatever you bind will be bound, it's the same thing when he tells the other apostles, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. It's like saying you have the keys too, because that's what the keys are for. So I think it's a mistake for the Roman Catholics to think that Peter alone receives this privilege.
Yeah, it keeps everyone under a man that isn't God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe it. I believe it's to the apostles as a class of chosen men. Now, of course, the Roman Catholics believe that the apostles, when they died, left successors in their office, and that when those men died, they left successors in their office, and that there's been a succession of apostolic men.
Okay, that sheds light on that part of it.
Yeah, see, they believe in what they call apostolic succession, which means that every generation of Christians has had living apostles, and that Peter's apostleship, especially since they believe he was over the Church of Rome, they believe that whoever is the Bishop of Rome at any given time is the successor of Peter, and therefore holds the office Peter had, and that the other bishops are the successors of the other apostles. I'm not sure how they work that out, since there were only 11 other apostles, and they have a lot more bishops than that, but the point is they believe that the group of bishops, the College of Bishops, as it's called, is the new apostolate, and therefore whatever authority Christ gave to the apostles now resides in the bishops of Rome, of the Roman Church, and the bishop of Rome himself, the one who's called the Pope, is the chief among them as far as they're concerned. But they're making far more of this verse than certainly.
So are they looking for the false Pope then, or the Antichrist to come through the Pope, or what are they looking for?
Well, I don't know that they're looking for that. I think they just recognize the Bishop of Rome as being able to speak like Peter himself. And whatever the Bishop of Rome and the College of Bishops agree upon formally becomes official church doctrine for the Roman Catholics.
Well, I just want to thank you for that, because you saved me hours and hours and hours of trying to learn about that stuff and understand where they're coming from. So thank you so much.
Okay, Brenda, thanks for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Good talking to you. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Jim calling from Seattle, Washington. I think all of our calls today have come from Washington and Oregon, which is fine. We've got more than one Washington caller waiting to talk yet. Jim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your wonderful ministry. I have a controversial question. In my reading of the Bible, I do not find a very clear, specific verse that prohibits premarital sex. In particular, the most specific verses I can find are in Leviticus 18, where it talks about various sexual prohibitions, but it doesn't say anything about single man, single woman. After that, then, of course, I'd love to hear your theory on divorced people getting remarried and the controversy about whether that now causes the new couple to commit adultery.
Okay, well, those are two very controversial questions, and I will be glad to address each of them. On the matter of premarital sex, I think you're correct that there's not a specific reference to premarital sex generically in the Bible in the sense of outright forbidding it. What the Bible does teach is that if an unmarried couple does have sex, then they are required to marry. That's in the law. That's in the Old Testament law, that if a man sleeps with a virgin who's not betrothed, he has to marry her, unless her father absolutely forbids it, in which case he has to pay the father a bride price, and obviously he's penalized because he's not marrying her. It's clear that God required people who did jump the gun like that to get married. Now, does that mean it's okay to have sex outside of marriage as long as you're going to get married? I don't think so. I think what it shows us is that God does not intend for sex to take place among people who are not married. And if someone does so, well, they have to remedy that by getting married, because they've done what should not be done by persons who haven't made any commitments to each other for marriage and made a covenant. It's not an outright forbidding of premarital sex, but it makes very clear, I think, what God's designs are for sex, that it is for married couples only. There's perhaps some very weird sexual practices that some people practice today that aren't mentioned in the Bible specifically, but which would still be, inappropriate. And the way we judge proper sexual behavior is not strictly from passages that forbid this or that activity, but from what the norm is that God intended for sex. Sex is not some minor thing like, it's not a minor human activity like eating. Now, eating is not minor either, but it's much less morally charged. You can eat whatever you want, and the worst thing you'll probably do is kill yourself or make yourself sick, but you will not defile yourself. Jesus said it's not what goes into a man's mouth that defiles a man, but what does defile a man is what comes out of his heart. And one of the things he mentions are fornications. Now, fornication, we usually use the word fornication to mean premarital sex or something like that. The word fornication, the Greek word porneia in the Bible, just means any kind of unlawful sex. So adultery, homosexual sex, bestiality, incest, these would be all different forms in the Bible of fornication, of porneia. Now, the Bible doesn't specifically list premarital sex as unlawful, but I believe that what's made very clear is that God has ordained sex for a purpose, and that purpose requires marriage. And like I said, in the Old Testament, if people had sex outside of marriage, they had to get married. They're not supposed to do that outside of marriage. So where someone might say, well, I guess I'm going to go ahead and have premarital sex because the Bible doesn't have a specific statement about it, forbidding it. A Christian's attitude should be, what is it that God wants me to do with these sexual drives? He wants me to be pure. He wants me self-controlled. He wants me to honor other people, of the opposite sex. In fact, Paul told Timothy, I guess it was, to treat younger women with all respect and treat them as sisters, and older women as mothers. In other words, Timothy, as a single man, I believe, was told that he's supposed to treat women with respect, and the younger women, the ones that might be, more attractive to him, he was to view them like sisters. And certainly, you don't, unless there's something wrong with you, you don't have sex with your sister. So I think that, without having a specific command, thou shalt not have premarital sex, we can still discover the mind of God on the matter. And that is that his desire is for people to get married and have sexual relationship in that case. And marriage is defined in the Bible as, a man and a woman who are both eligible to be married. Now, you brought up a second and related point. That is, what about divorced people who get married? Now, usually divorced people are a man and a woman. And if they marry heterosexually, some might say, well, then what's wrong with that? Well, the problem with that is divorced people in many cases are not really available to remarry, because many people get a divorce without biblical grounds. And Jesus said in Matthew 5:32, if a man divorces his wife for any grounds other than fornication, that means she's guilty of fornication. If he doesn't have those grounds and he divorces her, he causes her to commit adultery, and he himself commits adultery if he remarries. What Jesus seems to be saying is there is such a thing as a legal divorce that isn't a divorce in God's sight. There's a divorce that is not for proper grounds. And although the state may grant such a divorce, God doesn't. And therefore, people who have been divorced like that are not really divorced in God's sight. And if they remarry, they're committing adultery against the spouse that they're not really divorced from. There's only a few things that can really legitimately end a marriage. And I say legitimately, you know, is not really necessarily the best word because, frankly, they are not legitimate things. If a person goes out and has adulterous affairs and his wife divorces him, she has grounds for that. But that doesn't mean that was a legitimate thing because what he did was illegitimate. There's always sin. Whenever there's divorce, there's sin. There's either the sin on the part of the person who's giving their partner grounds, or there's sin on the partner's part who doesn't have grounds and gets a divorce. Now, if a person does have scriptural grounds, I don't believe that the Bible forbids remarriage. But many people don't have scriptural grounds. Where there is a scriptural ground for divorce, I believe the divorce ends the earlier marriage. And the person involved is now single. And for them to remarry doesn't violate any marriage covenant, so it's not adultery. But if their divorce is illegitimate, if their divorce has not been grounded in proper grounds, then they have the status in society of a divorced person because the state grants them a divorce. The courthouse gives them a divorce. But they're not really divorced. They don't have any grounds for divorce. And therefore, as far as God's concerned, they're still bound to their first spouse and can't remarry without thereby committing adultery.
Very interesting. Thank you very much.
All right, Jim. Good talking to you, brother.
You too. Bye.
God bless you. All right, Joshua from Everett, Washington is next. Joshua, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. How are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. I've got a couple of quick questions relating to Revelations and Daniel.
Okay.
First, I've grown up in churches that believe that the two passages in Revelations and Daniel are connected, and it's never been clearly explained to me why they believe that's the case. I see an argument for it, but I don't. It's not clear enough in my mind to say it's the truth.
Okay, which passages? Which passages in Daniel and which passages in Revelation?
I forget what chapter it is, but it's the passage in Daniel to do with the 70 weeks.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, the 70 weeks of Daniel give a time period from the end of the Jewish captivity in Babylon to the coming of the Messiah, and then to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And this 70 weeks means 70 periods of 7 years. A week in the passage means 7 years, and therefore the period of time is 490 years. Now, the passage in Daniel 9 divides this 70 weeks into three portions. There's 7 weeks and 62 weeks, which make up 69. And then there's one more week. Now, this one more week, there's great controversy over. And most dispensationalists, which is the viewpoint on Bible prophecy that's most common probably today in America among evangelicals, most dispensationalists believe that the 70th week, the last 7 years of Daniel's 70 weeks, is postponed. That the first 69 ran their course, but then there was a break, and that break is still broken, and that the 70th week is still remaining to come in the end times. And they believe that the book of Revelation is describing the events of that 70th week. Okay? Now, that's the connection they're making. Now, remember, the weeks in Daniel are 7 years each. So the 70th week is 7 years long. And if that's the same period Revelation's talking about, then Revelation is also talking about a period of 7 years. And you do find in Revelation a number of places where 3.5 years are mentioned. Five different times in Revelation you'll find some expression that's equivalent to 3.5 years. It might say time, times, and half a time, using a expression from Daniel. It might say 42 months, or it might say 1,260 days. In any case, that's 3.5 years. And so, since there are five references to 3.5 years in Revelation, and since dispensationalists believe that Revelation is talking about a 7-year period, the 70th week of Daniel, they suppose that there are two periods of 3.5 years, and that they go end to end. Now, Revelation doesn't say that. For all we could tell from Revelation itself, the 3.5 years might always refer to the same 3.5 years. But because the dispensationalists believe Revelation's talking about a 7-year period, they link two different periods of 3.5 years, and they make it out to be the 70th week of Daniel. Now, this view, although it's extremely popular, is not really, to my mind, supported from the text itself. There's nothing in Daniel 9 that indicates that there would be an interruption between the 69th week and the 70th week. You see, dispensationalists believe that Christ was crucified at the end of the 69th week, and that the 70th week has not happened yet. So we've got like a 2,000-year gap between the first 69 weeks and the last week of the series, that it's just been postponed for 2,000 years. And there's not the slightest hint in the book of Daniel that this is going to be the case, that there'd be any gap like this. And I don't believe it is the case.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you. The other thing is related directly to something I've heard you say, and I'd like you to explain it because in more detail because it intrigued me. And basically it boiled down to you said something about how dispensationalists discard historical fact in the first century about this seventh week, and I'm curious on your what you think that seventh week is, or excuse me, that 70th week is referring to historically.
Okay, yeah, I don't remember what I said about dispensationalists discarding historical fact, but I personally believe that the 70th week followed immediately upon the end of the 69th week. In other words, that the 70 weeks are consecutive weeks without any breaks. I'm not sure of this, but that's the easiest, most natural way to read the passage. Therefore, it is my assumption that Jesus' ministry began at the end of the 69th week, and therefore the beginning of his ministry, his baptism, marked the beginning of the 70th week. Now, what Daniel says is that he, the Messiah, will confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, meaning the 70th week. But in the midst of the week, he'll be cut off. He'll cause the sacrifice and offerings to cease. Jesus, I believe, after 3.5 years, in the middle of the 70th week, which began at his baptism, in the middle of that week, he caused an end of the sacrificial system by dying. Now, there were 3.5 years remaining after that, during which, as Daniel says about the weeks, God is still dealing with Israel. And I believe that 3.5 weeks ran until probably about the time Paul was called and was commissioned to go to the Gentiles. The first several years, we don't know the exact number, but the first several years of the church after Pentecost, ministry was only going out officially to Jews. God was still dealing with Israel primarily, and that's what the 70 weeks are about, God's dealings with Israel. So after Messiah was cut off, there's another 3.5 years, let's say, and it could have been exactly that length, or could have been approximately so, during which God was still only officially going out to the Jews. But when Paul was converted, he was commissioned to go as a Gentile, as an apostle to the Gentiles. And that would be the end of the period where the Jews were uniquely being dealt with.
Okay. Okay. Great. I think that's the clearest I've ever heard that explained. Thank you.
Okay, Joshua, I appreciate that. God bless
you.
Good talking to you. Tom from Squim, Washington is next. Tom, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Yeah, Steve, thanks for being there. I really appreciate your show.
Sure.
I listen every day. I had a question about my church. There's, you know, it's really neat, and I love going, and I think there's fellowshipping going on. But there's a couple of guys that we've been kind of have different opinions on, and that was Colossians 2:8 about keeping holy the Sabbath, and they say their opinion is that he's telling you that you need to get to church on Sunday, and I said, well, I take things really literal, and I said I don't see that there. It's keeping you know Sunday or the Sabbath holy and not working, enjoying your family and leisure, and it's a day of rest. And,
let me just interject here before we run out of time. The idea that Sunday is the Sabbath day has no biblical basis. Paul, when he used the word Sabbath, never was thinking of Sunday. The Sabbath was the seventh day of the week, which is Saturday. And therefore, whenever the Bible refers to the Sabbath, it's talking about Saturday. Whenever it's talking about a given day of the week as the Sabbath, it's talking about Saturday, because that's the only Sabbath anyone knew. You know, some people say that when Jesus rose from the dead on Sunday, that changed the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday, and therefore the Christians worshiped on Sunday. Well, it is true that Christians came to worship on Sunday to celebrate the resurrection of Christ, but it's not true that the Sabbath was changed from Saturday to Sunday, because the book of Acts describes the activities of Christians for maybe 20 or 30 years after the time of Jesus' resurrection, and the Sabbath is still mentioned in the book of Acts as Saturday. For example, we read that on the Sabbath day, Paul went into the synagogue at Pisidian Antioch to preach. Well, it means Saturday. That's when there'd be people there in the synagogue. There's no place in the Bible where Sunday has become the Sabbath day. Now, that doesn't mean that Sunday wasn't a day that Christians recognized as a special day, but they just didn't call it the Sabbath. Now, there's another issue, and that is whether Christians are supposed to be keeping the Sabbath or not. There's many Christians today who believe that we are obligated to keep the Sabbath day, and they think so because it's, of course, one of the Ten Commandments, and they think we should keep the Ten Commandments. As I understand the New Testament, there is no command for Christians to keep the Sabbath day, because that's the covenant sign of the Old Covenant. That's what God told the Jews in the 30th chapter of Exodus. He said that keeping the Sabbath is a covenant sign for them, between his covenant with them. Well, that was the Old Covenant. But the Bible says the new covenant has come, and the old covenant is obsolete. And therefore, the rules and laws of the old covenant do not define the obligations of people living under the new covenant. Jesus made a new covenant with his disciples in the upper room. He said, "This cup is the blood of the new covenant." And they drank it and participated in the new covenant. But that made the old one obsolete, and that means the rules of the old covenant are now supplanted by whatever the obligations are under the new covenant. Now, the new covenant is defined by the lordship of Jesus Christ, and whatever he said to his disciples is what is obligatory. Jesus said, "You are my disciples if you continue in all things that I say unto you, continue in my words." He said, "Go and make disciples, teaching them to observe all things I have commanded you." And so Jesus' words, Jesus' teachings, become the obligations of the new covenant. Not the obligations of the old covenant, just kind of carried over. And so the Sabbath, it was commanded in the old covenant. It was a sign of the old covenant. But the old covenant is gone. There's a new covenant. And the new covenant never mentions any obligation to keep the Sabbath. So although Sabbath is Saturday, not Sunday, Christians are not obligated to keep the Sabbath. They can if they want to, but they're not obligated to. Sunday is not the Sabbath, but Sunday has come to be a traditional day of worship for Christians, but it really doesn't matter what day you worship God. The early Christians worshiped every day. It says in Acts chapter 2 that they met daily from house to house, breaking bread and praying and sitting under the apostles' teaching and fellowshipping and so forth. So church for them was every day. It was a later church tradition to make it just one day a week and to make it Sunday. So your friend who thinks Sunday is the Sabbath is, I think, mistaken. But the whole discussion of whether one has to keep the Sabbath is a separate discussion for, at a different level. We're done today, I'm afraid. I'm sorry to those who are still waiting to talk to me. We're out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are a listener-supported ministry. Please go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and you can find out how you can donate to keep us on the air. That's thenarrowpath.com. I'm Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.